attending open-air mass with tens of thousands of people. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Songs of Ascension by Meredith Monk and Vocal Ensemble with visual elements by Ann Hamilton on Saturday, April 4th. More information is available online at KrannertCenter.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. We're also online at will.illinois.edu. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for public telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The 7th President of the United States, frontier and military hero Andrew Jackson, has been celebrated as the nation's first modern chief executive, moving the White House to the focus of national political attention. As Abraham Lincoln prepared to take office 28 years after Andrew Jackson, he studied Jackson's denial of South Carolina's threatened secession. Lincoln has not been alone in his admiration of Jackson, but at the same time, Jackson has been damned as a defender of slavery and the perpetrator of the Indian Removal Act. Journalist, editor, and author John Meacham says of Jackson, "Like us and our America, Jackson and his America achieved great things while committing grievous sins." John Meacham has written a new biography of Jackson, the title American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. And John Meacham is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join the discussion with a phone call. The numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The editor of Newsweek, Meacham is the author of American Gospel and Franklin and Winston. Those books and his new book, American Lion, Andrew Jackson and the White House, are published by Random House. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. John Meacham, good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Sure. You begin the book with a prologue that tells the story of Jackson just reelected to a second term as president. You describe him as furious and full of fight. He was angered by a challenge from South Carolina, and you say it was political and personal. What was happening?
He was the winter of 1832-33. The radicals in South Carolina, who ultimately would succeed in passing the Articles of Secession 30 years later, had launched a campaign with the very unsexy name of nullification. They wanted the ability to exercise a state veto over acts, with federal acts which they disagreed. They saw the tariff bills that came out of Washington as a prelude to abolition. They believed that if they could establish a precedent in which they could pick and choose which federal laws they wish to follow, then if the federal government in fact ever attempted to outlaw slavery, they would have that precedent. Jackson, interestingly, who had been born, he believed, in South Carolina, right on the North Carolina-South Carolina border, was a great states' rights Jeffersonian, called himself an old Republican of the Jefferson School. But he believed fervently in the Union, in the virtues of the country. I think it went back to his childhood in many ways. And he could not abide the idea that South Carolina or any state would do something that put the whole of the American experiment at risk. So he dispatched troops. He threatened to lead them himself. He said he would hang the first nullifier he could get his hands on. He sent cutters to Charleston Harbor. Winfield Scott went down to handle the military side of this. But all the while, he's sitting up late every night in the White House, writing letters to his allies on the ground in South Carolina, saying, whatever you do, don't make the first move. Make the nullifiers, the secessionists, the radicals, make them be in the wrong if we come to blows. And it really was, in many ways, I think, the first skirmish of the Civil War.
Yeah. How close was the young republic to coming apart that winter?
Well, you know, we were only a half century old. We forget that. And all you have to do to see how chaotic a seemingly mature political state is look at France in those very years, from the Revolution forward through Napoleon and through the sundry kings in the early part of the 19th century. I think we were closer than we had ever been, even during the War of 1812, when New England thought about seceding because they disagreed with that, chiefly because it involved the central flammable issue at the heart of the American Union, which had been the compromise over slavery. It was an uneven, uneasy balance that the founders had struck. Several felt guilty about it, obviously, down the years. But they believed that the only way to keep this geographically and economically disparate country together was to allow slavery in the South. And so insofar as the nullification crisis was linked to abolition, to slavery, it was, I think, easily the most dramatic threat to the Union before Sumter.
Mm. What did Abraham Lincoln glean from Jackson's response to the nullification crisis?
Well, you know, you mentioned it. He was sitting, to get away from office seekers and autograph seekers in Springfield in between the election in November 1860 and the inauguration and leaving for Springfield. He retreated to his brother-in-law's store there in downtown Springfield and sat on the second floor. And he only sent for four documents as he wrote the great first inaugural. He sent for a copy of the Constitution, a copy of Webster's reply to Hayne in the Webster-Hayne debates, Henry Clay's speech on the Compromise of 1850, and Andrew Jackson's proclamation of the 10th of December, 1832, to the people of South Carolina, in which Jackson lays out a vision of the Union that is quite Websterian, if you will, in its passion, in its fervor, in its intellectual underpinnings, that, in fact, the Union preexisted the states, the people. The country had been founded in the name of the people, not the people of different states, and that, at first principles, America was America before it was a confederation of states. Lincoln needed that kind of passion. He also needed the very straightforward tactical lesson of the winter you initially asked about, which was, and Lincoln said this, that the right of a state to secede was fully discussed in Jackson's time and decided by him that it could not happen. And so Lincoln, who was basically a Henry Clay man, was, in a weird way, I think, sent for Jackson in that terrible winter. It was said that there were people in 1860 who were still trying to vote for General Jackson, believing that he was the only one who could save the Union. He'd been dead for 15 years at that point. So. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that to Lincoln, Henry Clay was such an important figure, and for Jackson, he was a rival, Henry Clay.
Oh, Clay and Jackson hated each other with operatic grandeur. It was mutual. It was deep. It was one of the defining political rivalries of the age. It makes Lyndon Johnson and Bobby Kennedy look like playmates in its depth and stridency. Jackson later said that his only two regrets in public life had been that he had not shot John Calhoun and hung Henry Clay. So that gives you some sense of it. They were rivals from the West. They were both, one was a son of Kentucky, the other from Tennessee. Clay was a much more overtly politically sophisticated figure. He was a hard drinker and a card player and said to be something of a womanizer. He had a difficult family situation. They had a son who was an alcoholic, and that took a great toll on Clay. But Clay was very much a John Quincy Adams kind of man. He was someone who believed in government by the elite, that, in fact, the Constitution, as literally written with the Electoral College, the indirect election of senators, was the best way to govern. And Jackson believed that the people should not simply be one element in the puzzle, but the central element. And he saw Clay as an impediment to that, and he was right in many ways. One of the things that we've forgotten in our sort of public conversation, understandably, given we have a lot to keep up with now, but the really dramatic election of 1824, which was kind of like the closest thing to 2000 we've had, in which Jackson had won a plurality of both the popular vote and the Electoral College vote, but did not have the constitutional requirement to win. The election went to the House of Representatives at that point, and Clay, who had run third in that election, threw his support to John Quincy Adams, electing Adams over Jackson. Jackson had been the people's choice, and Clay then quickly became the Secretary of State. Secretary of State used to be what we think of as the vice presidency now. It was the office from which presidents sprang. And so Jackson saw really the whole thing as the theft of the presidency. And it was from him, obviously, but he also believed it was from the people. And he began to call it the corrupt bargain in one of the first great sound bites in American politics, the corrupt bargain between Clay and Adams, and really never stopped running after that decision in 1824-25. He ultimately won the election in 1828, defeating Adams and avenging that. But it was incredibly important in the development of the world in which we now live, because we had been very much a constitutional republic before 1828. We became an American democracy after Jackson. And one of the things you have to ask if you're in my business is, can you make a case for someone as a truly transformational and irreplaceable historical figure if there were other people around who might have been able to accomplish the same things? That is, if there had been other people who were of the same cast of mind as Jackson in the 1820s, and if Jackson had, if one of the two bullets he carried around in him, for instance, had killed him, what would have happened? And I do think that history would be radically different if Jackson had not been where he was, because the first six presidents of the United States had been either members of Virginia gentry or an Adams from Massachusetts. Mm. Jackson was the first self-made man to become president, and he proved something in doing that, which was that the democratic possibilities of the country were not simply rhetorical, but were real.
Mm. And did all this play a role in the demise of the Bank of the United States?
Oh, Lord. Yes, it's all quite resonant. I live in New York, and so I keep expecting to see Jackson riding on a horse on his way to AIG. It's been that kind of week here. Yeah, absolutely. Jackson saw the country in really classical political terms. The image the ancients used was, of course, the people, the public, as the body politic. And so they used medical analogies often. If the reason we say something is corrupt is because it is making the body politic sick, it's an illness. And so Jackson saw any large or small institution that stood between the president and the people as a potentially cancerous, infectious, choose your word, factor. And so the Electoral College was something that could thwart the will of the people. So that should go. That was a corrupting institution. He disliked ministers, liked religious people, but disliked ministers because he believed that they were a potentially corrupting element. And chiefly, what you just raised, the Bank of the United States, Second Bank of the United States, which was not quite like our Federal Reserve. It was a bank in which the federal government deposited the taxpayers' money, which then threw off profit for private shareholders. And Jackson believed that they were corrupting the franchise, that they were attempting to influence elections in which pro-bank and anti-bank people were running, and declared war on it in 1832, vetoed its recharter, and wrote what is an incredibly resonant document right this minute in 1832, the bank veto message, which is really the urtext of modern populism, in which he said that it is to be regretted that the rich and well-connected too often bend the purposes of government to their selfish ends, so that the unconnected, the farmers, the mechanics, and the laborers were justified in claiming that it was unfair. It was really the kind of sentiment you would hear from William Jennings Bryan, which you'd hear to some extent even from Franklin Roosevelt and populists down the ages unto this hour. And he destroyed the bank. The bank was politically inept, like all opponents of Jackson. Nicholas Biddle, the head of the bank, underestimated him, or as President Bush would say, misunderestimated him. Jackson was very lucky in his career in that, rather like Ronald Reagan to some extent, people outside his immediate circle always tended to underestimate him. And he bent the country to his will in a formidable way.
The impact, though, of the demise of the National Bank was pretty huge, though, as well. Didn't it lead to the Panic of 1837? And isn't that another resonant kind of situation here today?
Yes, one would have wished that Jackson had taken a more moderate middle course. Andrew Jackson didn't take moderate and middle courses in most things. And the panic, there's great scholarly debate, as always. We don't even understand what we're going through right now, much less the economy of 1837. But it was disruptive. It was difficult. And one would have wanted a more judicious way of being. But by, I think, in the long view of history, by destroying what he believed to be a bastion of aristocratic self-perpetuating privilege, he opened the government, he opened the country a bit more than it would have been otherwise. And I think we've always been strongest when we have expanded the definition of the mainstream, when we've allowed in those who have been somehow left out. And we are strong, I believe, in direct relation and proportion to our openness and our generosity. And Jackson was, when he put his mind to it, an incredibly generous and open man. He also had, as you mentioned before, epic sins. And my sense of Andrew Jackson is that he represents the best of us and the worst of us. His record on slavery, his record on Indian removal are both egregious. But it's also true that America's record on those two things is quite egregious. And so before we too rapidly condemn him and push him off the stage as someone who is irredeemable, I think we have to take a step back and think about what did the country itself allow to happen that he may have come to personify. And as Arthur Schlesinger used to say, self-righteousness in retrospect is easy and also cheap. We have a lot of problems today that our children and our grandchildren will look back and say, how could you all have let this happen?
Yeah. John Meacham is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of a new biography of Andrew Jackson, American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. You say Jackson could be both unspeakably violent toward Indians and decidedly generous. In a letter to the Creek, he told them in order for them to survive, they'd have to be relocated. What were his views on Indians and how did he come by them?
He saw the Native American populations, particularly in what we now think of as the southeastern United States, as a potentially destabilizing and threatening element of life. He believed from his experience on the frontier in Tennessee, in warfare against the British and the Spanish in 1812 and forward, that the Indians were, in a way, potential allies for the foreign enemies of the United States, and tribes that had been allied with the British or the Spanish, or who, on their own, for their own reasons, had been hostile to white settlement. Settlement's a nice word for it. It's also just a huge land grab. Theft is another word for it. The Jackson's tendency in Indian affairs was to talk paternalistically, to make the right proper noises about, I am your great father and I want to take care of you, my little red children, as he put it, and then act rather callously and cruelly. And one of the great tragedies of American life and of Jackson's life is his inability to match his, to take paternal action that matched his paternal rhetoric. The Trail of Tears is directly attributable to Andrew Jackson. And people, sometimes defenders of Jackson, say, well, he was out of office or it was an administrative problem. You cannot, I reject that, you cannot treat Jackson as a heroic figure when you agree with what he is doing, as a, you know, and cannot treat him as an all-powerful, transformative man. And then when he does something or doesn't do something with which we disagree, say, well, it was someone else's fault. He was the same man throughout. And he simply didn't care enough to take care of the Indians in terms of their removal. He was particularly unjust, I believe, against the Cherokee Nation, which had done everything the white man had asked. You know, it had, they owned slaves, for God's sake. I mean, they'd taken on the worst habits of the whites. And simply could not, for reasons of the racism of the time, greed for the land, fears for national security, in the terms as he defined the nation, he simply wanted the Indians out. And so he drove them out. And except for a quite ferocious debate in 1830 over the enabling legislation and a big moral debate, there wasn't a great deal of resistance, ultimately. There was a great moral campaign, not unlike abolition, for the Indians' rights on the front end of removal, but it dissipated rather quickly. There's a wonderful man named Jeremiah Evarts, who was in some ways the William Lloyd Garrison of Indian removal. Almost no one remembers Evarts, and I think that's because Garrison won and Evarts lost.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. John Meacham, our guest. He's the author of American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. Let's take a call now from a listener in Urbana. Line one, hi.
Hello. It seems to me you neglect perhaps the most important aspect of Jackson's administration, that under his vice president, during his administration, if the patronage system wasn't invented, it was perfected, and it poisoned the American system for almost two centuries since then.
Political patronage.
Yes.
Yeah. Removal in office was the subject of great philosophical debate at the time. Jeremy Bentham, in fact, of all people, was someone who wrote rather extensively on the virtues, vices of rotating political appointees, federal officials, in and out of office. Jackson took a quite ideological view of this. He believed that an encrusted federal bureaucracy would be self-perpetuating and could then begin to work against the interests of the people. Bentham shared that view, actually wrote a letter to Jackson approving what he did. It got an unfortunate name when a senator from New York referred to it as the spoils system, saying that to the victor go the spoils. And so it is a mixed legacy. Jackson very much ramped up the rate at which federal office holders were turned over, and that lasted certainly until civil service reform began to limit the number of political offices. There were some corruption scandals that make a lot of what our scandals are today look rather mild by comparison. But I think for our purposes in thinking about how we got to be the way we are, I think the thing to take away from Jackson's view of political office holding is that he saw a permanent civil service as a potential threat to democratic intentions. And he was a much more Jackson would not have been uncomfortable in the California of today. He was much more of a direct Democrat, lowercase d, than almost any other president.
Does a listener want to follow up?
Yes, I would. It seems that may have been Jackson's purpose, but certainly Van Buren used it as a spoil system.
Oh, Jackson
used
it.
It was under Jackson, and Jackson bears the responsibility.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Van Buren, of course, was vice president only in the second term. Absolutely. There's no question that it was used as a spoil system. And my only point is that Jackson saw it and did see it in some philosophical terms, even though he may have acted politically.
It may be difficult to make the point that Jackson pushed Calhoun far to the right. Calhoun certainly was as bitter a man as Jackson could be, but Calhoun was a much less states' rights when he was vice president, and until Van Buren managed to cut him out of the scheme of things rather effectively. And he went over to the influence of the extremists. I can't think of the fellow's name, the inventor of the nullification. But at any rate, even afterward, Calhoun probably was as influential as any man in holding the Union together.
Well, I think we may part company on that last point. I think Calhoun was at heart a political opportunist, and I don't mean that in a horribly negative way. I think he was, you know, he started out as a war hawk in the War of 1812, quite a great nationalist. He became a, as you say, I would call him sort of a moderate on nullification, who ultimately was pushed to the far right. My sense of Calhoun is that he wanted to be president of something, and if it couldn't be the United States, then the Confederate States might be fine. And that he was someone who allowed, well, he had a very odd combination of bare-knuckled political ambition married to a high philosophical turn of mind, and was often quite abstract. Henry Clay used to describe him as someone he could barely understand sometimes. And ultimately, I think South Carolina bears a great deal of responsibility in its totality for really exacerbating the tensions and fanning the tensions that ultimately led us to disunion and civil war. And I think Calhoun certainly is not entirely to blame, but is by any means, but is ultimately a figure who played a role in leading to the Civil War.
I want to thank the listener for his call, and let's take another call now. Listener in Urbana on line two. Hello.
Good afternoon. I'm enjoying the interview. Mr. Meacham, could you please discuss the relationship between Andrew Jackson and John Quincy Adams, who were both young teenagers during the time of the Revolution, and between Andrew Jackson and Sam Houston?
Absolutely. The first one, Jackson and John Quincy Adams. Adams, as you said, they were both young during the Revolution. Adams, of course, was part of a noble and, I mean, a hardworking family that became noble. But a very, we all know the Adams family saga. Jackson, down in South Carolina, and in both during the Revolution and then later, was very much part of that brutal civil war, lowercase c, lowercase w in this case, during the Revolution. He was a messenger boy in the Revolutionary Army. He was struck over the head by a saber from a British officer who had asked him to ordered him to shine his boots. Jackson had refused. He bore that scar until the day he died. It was joked at, right after the Battle of New Orleans, that was not a particularly wise move for that British officer. They ultimately paid for it rather dearly. Adams was, as Secretary of State under Monroe, was actually a defender of Jackson's when Jackson preemptively invaded Florida to help drive the Spanish out. It was Adams back in Washington who defended him while John Calhoun and others in that cabinet were denouncing him and wanted him censured, partly it did knock him out of political rival, because he was General Jackson was arguably the greatest national celebrity since George Washington. Then came 1824, which we discussed, in which Jackson believed that Adams had capitalized on elite connections and unfair means to capture the presidency. There's a sweet story actually about being at the Monroe White House the night he lost the presidency. Jackson had a woman on each arm and approached Adams and met the moment with great grace and great skill. He said, "Mr. Adams, I would extend my hand, but as you can see, I have given my arms to the fair. How do you do? All the best." And then moved on. And Adams, who was not exactly a hail fellow well met person in the best of times, sort of stumbled over himself a bit. And so word spread around Washington that Jackson had done the diplomatic thing, and this so-called military chieftain and potential Bonaparte had been quite dignified in that moment. Jackson never spoke to him again. They were in church together on occasion in 1829 forward. Adams kept, as you know, an amazing diary, published in 12 volumes, I think, and more of it up in the Adams Place in Massachusetts. A brilliant portrait of life in those years, I think unparalleled, really. Adams was quite bitter about Jackson, saw him as a barbarian to some extent. Adams actually objected to Harvard granting, his alma mater, granting Jackson an honorary degree, and said that he could not believe they would give it to a barbarian who could barely spell his name. So that gives you some sense of their relationship. Houston, and of course then Adams ended up in the House of Representatives and had a noble second career.
Yes.
While Jackson retired to Tennessee. Sam Houston, who was a wonderful topic, just a great Tennessean, fled to Texas, left several wives, was known as Big Drunk, all sorts of things.
I'm not up on my Houston, but wow.
Yeah, no, he was Houston and Jackson never disappointed. They were sort of the J.R. Ewings of their day, I guess. He was became a critical figure in the independence of Texas. Jackson was obsessed with getting Texas into the Union. And, in fact, that was what he was doing in retirement, writing dozens of letters about it when he went into his final decline and died. And Houston was traveling rapidly from Texas to be with his friend in his last days, did not reach him in time, but got to the Hermitage there in Nashville when Jackson was lying in repose. And Houston turned to his son, who was with him, and said, "Always remember, my son, that you have looked upon the face of Andrew Jackson."
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So Andrew Jackson is a small D Democrat, he accepted slavery as part of life. What was his opinion of the movement for abolition?
He was against it, as they would say in Tennessee in those days. Jackson was entirely a creature of his time in terms of slavery. His newspaper, the Washington Globe, which he founded about 1830 when he was annoyed with the coverage he was getting in Washington, actually made a few interesting progressive statements on slavery in those days, but almost entirely Jackson was a foe of abolition. He saw abolition, interestingly, as a threat to the Union. He was a slave owner. He could be a terrible master. So there's no excusing any of that. But what he did do was represent the quite conventional view of the time that that rickety compromise about slavery was at the heart of the Union. And abolitionists in the North who were agitating, who were sending mailings to the South, who were trying to change slavery, abolish it, were in fact tampering with the Union. And so while he did the right thing in nullification on behalf of the Union, he did the wrong thing on behalf of the Union in when it came to abolition. And my argument is one reason to note Jackson's life with care and heed him is he did something that I think the greatest presidents always do, which is he kept the possibility of democratic progress alive. If the Union had fallen apart, we would not have ever gotten to the abolition of slavery and ultimately the expansion of the American promise. It was bloody. It was difficult. It took too long. He stands forever condemned, I believe, before the bar of history and the bar of the future for his treatment of the Indians, for his treatment of African Americans. And yet he was someone who believed in the country enough to preserve the country through storm and strife and ultimately to give us a Lincoln, which then gave us a TR, who then gave us an FDR, which then gave us a Lyndon Johnson, and ultimately gave us a Barack Obama. And so in the long sweep of history, Jackson, I think, on the whole, was a force for good.
Hmm. During his two terms in office, there were so many crises that he faced, and one of them, very interesting crisis, the crisis of John Henry Eaton as Secretary of War. What was that all about, and how did he handle it?
For people who are skeptical that a fight over a woman could cause enormous political and social upheaval, I submit the Iliad as an example of another case in which this happened. Very briefly, John Henry Eaton, who was as close to Jackson as anyone, a Tennessean who became the Secretary of War, married a woman during the transition between Jackson's election and his inauguration, a woman who probably was not all she could have been in terms of sexual morality. Certainly she was a difficult woman to be around. My sense of her, after spending a lot of time reading about this, is that she's rather like Lydia in Pride and Prejudice. She would have run off with Wickham. And Margaret Eaton became, whether one received or did not receive, the wife of the Secretary of War in Washington drawing rooms, became a sign of whether you supported or opposed the president himself. This led to an entire firing of the cabinet. It consumed more of Jackson's time than almost any other issue in his first 2 years as president. I know this sounds completely implausible, but it's true. And what it really, the significance ultimately, aside from its just novelistic interest, is that the South Carolinian forces, the more conservative, what we would think of as conservative, even radical forces, began to see this affair as a weakness on Jackson's part, a way to gain the upper hand, the advantage over Jackson politically, and possibly even affect who won the presidency after Jackson. In one of the great, perhaps unintentional, double entendres in all of American historical writing, James Parton, who was Jackson's great first biographer in the 1860s, once wrote, in talking about how Martin Van Buren had capitalized on the affair by accepting Mrs. Eaton and becoming a favorite of Jackson's, how he became president instead of Calhoun, Parton wrote that American history changed forever at the moment Mr. Van Buren put his soft hand on Mrs. Eaton's knocker. And so how all this ultimately affected the country is, I know, strange credulity when you're just hearing about it, but it was a consuming, difficult, and defining crisis in those years.
Yeah. Well, going back to his early runs for the presidency, Jackson faced some controversy or some criticism due to a woman, his wife, Rachel Donelson Jackson. That was rough campaign, that 1824 and 28.
Yeah. It was quite brutal. For people who think that Karl Rove just invented all this, I refer you to the early history of the country. Mrs. Jackson was attacked as an adulteress and a whore. She was attacked as a bigamist. She and Jackson had married before her divorce from her first husband had been legally and finally granted. My sense is they probably knew that, though they ultimately denied it. It was not as out of the cultural question as it seems now, or seemed in the 1820s, in 1799, when all this was happening, for people on the frontier to do this. She was, by all accounts, a quite noble and important woman. She was one of the few people who could calm Jackson down. She died had a heart attack between the election and the inauguration in 1828-29. Jackson always believed that his opponent's attacks on her virtue had killed her, and so he was an unforgiving foe of those he believed had harmed her. She was, interestingly, rather like a lot of men, I think. Jackson loved his wife rather more than he listened to her. She was always writing letters begging him, whether he was at the front in the army or in politics, to come home, to retire to the Hermitage, to live a simpler life with her. And Jackson would write back saying, yes, that is my fondest, most ardent wish. But then he would do exactly what he wanted. He once said, I was born for a storm, and a calm does not suit me. And he just couldn't avoid the fight. He was someone who was entirely wired that way from his earliest days, from the Revolution to fighting Indian wars to the realms of politics. He was someone who believed that he was most alive and was indeed destined to be in a kind of eternal combat.
And some hailed him as a second father of his country, while others plotted to kill him.
Yeah. He was an incredibly divisive figure. He was like Bill Clinton in that way, like Richard Nixon in that way, like George W. Bush. He inspired enormous loyalty and deep hatred. He was hailed in military terms after his victory at New Orleans in 1815 as the man who had finished the work, really, against the British. What Washington had started, he finished by getting the British out of the mainland forever. And would have been forever hailed as a hero if he had not gone into politics. But he did, and became a figure who either you wanted to die for or you wanted to kill. There were very few people who were neutral on the question of Jackson.
And he was targeted for assassination.
Twice. First time a president had been the object of an attack. The second one in January of 1835 is the most interesting because he was coming out of a funeral service for a member of Congress through the Capitol Rotunda, and an unemployed house painter, deranged man, came up to him, fired two percussion pistols at him. Neither one went off. The odds of that were about 125,000 to one. Jackson began to attack the man, and in fact, his aides had to pull him off the assailant, get him in a carriage, and get him back to the White House. he is, in fact, and in fact, I should say, the reason I wrote this book was I decided that any president who tried to attack his own assassin was intrinsically interesting.
Yeah. What were his final years at the Hermitage like before his death in June of 1845?
He couldn't ever fully retire. He became ever more religious as he grew older. He had refused to join a church when he was in politics because he believed it would be seen as overtly political and possibly cynical. Times have changed.
Mm-hmm.
He was very much a separationist of church and state. But as he grew older, he, as tends to happen, he became more interested in his maker and was a great writer of letters, a great lobbyist for the causes he believed in, was a constant correspondent of Martin Van Buren's and James K. Polk's. Polk was known as Young Hickory. He campaigned quite strongly for Texas to become part of the Union. He received a stream of visitors. It's almost inconceivable to us now, but it was expected in those days that anyone who came to the house would be seen by the former president. And so he was basically running an open shrine constantly. He was never in very good health. He carried two bullets around, from one from a gunfight in Nashville, the other from a duel he fought over Rachel's honor. One of the bullets was removed without anesthetic in the White House when he was president, but the other stayed in till the day he died. And he was someone who was, I think, in constant pain. One of the reasons he was short-tempered, I think, is that he was always always just on the edge of pain or in the midst of it. And I should say one of the things that brought him the greatest joy was his intimate family circle. He had been an orphan. He lost his father before he was born.
Mm-hmm.
His mother had died in the Revolution. He was alone in the world at 14. And because of this, he always had to be surrounded by people. And he was known as Uncle Jackson to this great host of adopted family members, and was really an incredible father figure, not only to the country, which he explicitly believed, he spoke of himself in those terms, but also to this quite intimate family circle in Nashville.
There we have to leave it. John Meacham, thank you for talking with us this afternoon.
Delighted. Thank you.
John Meacham is the author most recently of American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. The book is published by Random House. It's 1:53. Let's go to Todd Gleason now. He has settlement prices from Chicago and Kansas City.
Thanks, Celeste. Let's take a look at those numbers as they finished up in Chicago on this Thursday afternoon. Futures like this may contract in the wheat pit. A gain today of 25.25 cents. The high at 559.5. The low at 537.75. Settlement price at $5.55.25. 25.25 for the May wheat on the higher side. July contract 572. The high. The low at 550.75. Settled $5.67.75. Up 25.25 in September. 594.75. The high. The low at 84.5. A settlement price at $5.91.75 a bushel. Up 24.75 cents. July wheat in Kansas City, where they trade hard red, not soft red, but the hard red from the Great Plains State, at 6.16¾, up 23 cents in Kansas City. From the corn pit back in Chicago, an 8.25 cent gain for the nearby May contract, with a 402.5 top, ranging down to a low of 393.5, with a settlement price up 8.25 cents at $3.96.5 per May corn. July futures 4.13 the high. The low at 404, settled 407, 8.5 higher in September, 421.75. The high, the low at 13, settlement price at $4.16¼, up 9 cents. December futures 434.5, the high, the low at $4.24¼. The new crop settled at $4.28¼ for the harvest month. December corn futures 9.5 cents higher. The following contract, March futures at $4.39¼ on the settlement, up 9.5 as well, with a high of 45 and a low at 35¼. For the March 2010 corn contract, May oat futures 201 up 7¾, July at 209¾ up 7¾. Soy complex, May beans 952¾ the high. low at $9.28 and a quarter. Settlement price at $9.40 and a half, up 25 and a half. July, $9.51 and a half on the high. The low at 26, settled at $9.40, up 28 and a quarter. And soybeans finished the August at $9.37 on the high. The low at $9.08, settled a dime below that top, but still at $9.27 and a quarter, up 31 and a quarter cents. September, $9.10 and a quarter the high. The low at $8.77. Settled 902 and 3 quarters, up 34 and 3 quarters. November beans, $8.99 and a half. The high, the low at $8.67 and a half. A settlement price at $8.92 and a half, up 36 and a half for November 2009. Soybeans, the January 2010 contract, up 36 cents today to settle at $9 a penny and a half. May bean meal futures, $300.30 the top, the bottom at $2.92.50. Settlement price at $2.96.30, up $6.80. July contract at $2.93 in the bean meal, up $7.60. May bean oil at $32.50 high, the low at $31.31 with a settlement price at $31.89, 97 cents higher. And July bean oil settled 97 higher as well to finish at $32.16 on a Thursday afternoon. Just a bit later in the day here, about 9 minutes away now. During the closing market report, we'll talk with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group out of Decatur, Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Let's take a look now at livestock contracts and how they finished today in Chicago. April live cattle, 85.50 the high, 84.15 the low, 84.75 the settlement, that up 120. June, 83.60 the high, 82.25 the low, 83.12 and a half the settlement, that up 172 and a half. August, 84.90 the high, 83.60 the low, 84.22 and a half the settlement, that up 140. October, 88.45 the high, 87.15 the low, the settlement 87.97 and a half, up 140. March feeder cattle, 94.27 and a half the high, 93.80 the low, 94.25 the settlement, that up 117 and a half. April, 94.75 the high, 93.60 the low, 94.30 the settlement, that up 137 and a half. May, 95.85 the high, 94.65 the low, 95.72 and a half the settlement, that up 167 and a half. August, 99.15 the high, the low 98.30, the settlement 98.90, up 112 and a half. April lean hog, 62.85 the high, 62 even the low, 62.05 the settlement, that down 20. May, 74.10 the high, 73.10 the low, 73.47 and a half the settlement, that finishing up 40. June, 75.92 and a half the high, 74.80 the low, 74.95 the settlement, that up 47 and a half. And July, 76.90 the high, 75.70 the low, 75.77 and a half the settlement, that up 5. May pork bellies, 92.60 the high, 90.50 the low, 91.75 the settlement, that finishing up 152 and a half. It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. The Dow is currently off 95 points, the NASDAQ down 9, the S&P 500 down 10. Oil, nearby month in New York, up 347 at 51.15. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Henry Frayne is our technical director. Mike Solis forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. Mostly sunny, highs ranging from around 40 near Lake Michigan to 60 in southern Illinois. Tonight, fair, colder. Lows ranging from 20 in northwestern Illinois to 34 in southern Indiana. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs ranging from 40 in northeastern Indiana to around 60 in southwestern Illinois. In Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, mostly sunny, cooler, the high around 55, the wind from the north at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, clear, the low 29, the wind from the northeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, sunny, the high 50, the wind from the east at 6 to 20.